Welcome to Lectionary at Lunch. I'm Dr. David Adams, and this week we will be examining, as our Old Testament lesson, Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 1 to 10. In this passage, God reminds Israel of the purpose for which he is giving them his teaching. So let's get right into the text. Chapter 8, verse 1. Kol ha-mitzvah asher anoki mitzavka hayom tishmarun la'asoth. Every commandment which I am commanding you today, you shall be careful to keep. The text begins with call, combined with a singular noun. This usage can imply each or every when it is conceived of individually, or something like the whole of when conceived of collectively. In the context here, God does not appear to be speaking about the whole law as a single block, but of the necessity of keeping each and every one of the individual things that God is teaching Israel. The verb mitzavka is a PL participle from tsawa, command, with a second-person masculine singular object suffix, implying that the action of commanding is ongoing. God is not yet finished teaching Israel his ways. Finally, the combination of verbs at the end of the phrase, Tishmarun la'asoth, the roots shamar and asa used together. This combination is regularly employed throughout the Torah to emphasize the need to be diligent in doing what God has taught. In that sense, you shall keep to do means you shall be careful to do. The verse continues, Lama'an tichyun uravithim ubathem uyir shithim et haaretz asher nishba Yahweh la'avofekim, so that you may live and multiply and enter and possess the land that Yahweh swore to your fathers. Here, the idea Yahweh swore to your fathers means Yahweh swore an oath to give it to your fathers. First, we note that the editors of BHS suggest deleting this entire phrase. However, this is purely a hypothetical suggestion on their part, and there's no form of the text in which this phrase does not occur. So there are no grounds for removing the passage. In addition, the fact that each of the next two verses contains a similar purpose clause adds to the likelihood that this one is original as well. The phrase is a purpose clause that states for Israel the motivation for keeping the instruction of God, that they may live and enter into and possess the land that God had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And this promise reemerges near the end of our text. Verse 2. Vazakerta el kol haderek asher holikka Yahweh Eloheka ze erbaim shana bamidbar. And you shall remember all the way which Yahweh your God has led you for these 40 years in the wilderness. The wow consecutive perfect of zakar that begins the verse continues the force of the previous sentence, instruction for the future. As in the first verse, we have call used with the singular. Unlike the previous verse, however, the context implies the entirety of the journey that has gone before, not just a collection of individual trips. So we've translated all the way, or perhaps the whole way, and not every way. The verb halak here is interesting. The holam, following the initial consonant, the he, makes it look like it ought to be a call participle from halak. However, the hirik yod vowel in the middle makes that impossible. So what is this? The answer is that it's a hifil perfect from halak. The form is a third masculine singular with a second masculine singular object suffix. So why the odd-looking pointing? First, remember that the root halak behaves as if it were a first yod verb that was originally first wow. so the original vowel returns and forms a diphthong with the pothok vowel of the hyphal. This gives rise to the long O vowel, the holum. Usually, that vowel is written with a wow as a vowel letter. But here it's written without the vowel letter, what grammarians describe as defective spelling. It is this defective spelling that makes the form difficult to parse, since the wow that would have given it away is missing in this case. Lama'an, anothaka, lanasothaka, lada'ath ethesher bilavaka, hatishmor mitzawothau imlo. In order that he might humble you, by testing you to know what was in your heart, would you keep his commandment or not? The verb anothaka is a PL infinitive construct from ana, to humble or put to the test. Remember, the third he verbs always form their infinitive constructs with the ending oath. This is followed by another similar form, the PL infinitive construct from nasa, to try or put to the test. Both the forms lanasothka and lada'ath are infinitive constructs preceded by a lamed preposition, but the preposition performs different functions on each of the two forms. On the form lada'ath, the lamed introduces purpose, for the purpose of knowing. But on the form lanasothka, the lamed indicates the means by which an action is performed. He humbled you by means of testing you. There's an interesting grammatical construction at the end of this verse. The appositive that fills out the meaning of the phrase, what was in your heart, is here in the form of a question. The form hatishmor is a call imperfect second masculine singular of the root shamar, keep. The hey on the front is a hey interrogative. Will you keep? Or perhaps better, since it refers to an unknown quality, would you keep? The next word, mitzvothau, as pointed, is a kathiv karei. A kathiv karei, as you may recall, is a place where the Masoretes believe that the consonantal text is in error. However, instead of changing the received text, they preserve what they believe to be the correct reading by placing the consonants of that reading in the margin of the manuscript and placing the vowels of what they believe to be the correct form in the text itself. This produces an incorrect form, which is supposed to signal the reader to look in the margin and read the correct form. In this case, the consonants in the text preserve a singular form, mitzvotho, his commandment. But the Masoretes believe that the correct reading is a plural, mitzvothau, his commandments, plural, as it is in verse 6 below. The theological point being made here is a common one in the Old Testament. God puts Israel to the test so that what is hidden in secret in their heart would be revealed publicly through their deeds, just as God reveals himself publicly through his public deeds on the stage of history. Verse 3. Vayanothka, vayar ivecha, vayakilka, ethaman asher lo yadata, Walo yadun avothecha. So he humbled you and caused you to hunger. Then he fed you manna, which you did not know and your fathers did not know. The wow here introduces a result clause. God's action in humbling Israel is a result of his desire to put them to the test. The verb is a PL wow consecutive imperfect, third masculine singular, with a second masculine singular object suffix of the third he root ana, ayin nun he. It is followed by a hyphal wow consecutive imperfect, Vayer Ivecha. Here with the Hithiel causative force, he caused you to hunger. God's desire to have Israel demonstrate its faith in a public way reflects God's own action in demonstrating himself trustworthy by meeting the need that he created through the provision of manna. The reference to manna is followed by the phrase, which you did not know and your fathers did not know. The phrase is apparently an allusion to the play on words in Exodus 16:15 that connects the Hebrew form of the name man with the words that Israel spoke when they first saw it. What is it? Hebrew, manhu. In Exodus 16:15, the text goes on to say that Israel asked this question, for they did not know what it was. And it's that not knowing that's picked up here in Deuteronomy, verse 3. The next phrase focuses on the didactic or teaching purpose of God's action. The ma'an hodiaka ki lo al halechem levado yihye l'ha'adam. In order to teach you that not by bread alone does man live. In the verb hodiaka, the causative force of the hifil is again apparent. To cause to know means to teach. The key following introduces what grammarians call indirect discourse. Though here, of course, it's not technically discourse, but simply an indirect expression in which something is described rather than stated directly. The next clause also begins with key, but there the key introduces a contrasting statement, another fairly common use of key in Hebrew. Ki al kol motza pi Yahweh yechye ha'adam. But by everything that comes out of the mouth of God does man live. Here again, the emphasis is on the need to keep each individual provision of God's instruction. Verse 4. Sumlatika lo balatha me'alecha v'raglecha lo batzecha ze abayim shana. Your clothing did not wear out from upon you, and your feet did not swell up for these 40 years. Here we get more information that underscores God's care and provision for Israel. Just as he provided food for them in the wilderness, so also did he care for them by ensuring that they were clothed and able to follow his leading. The verb simla can refer either to one's cloak or outer garment, something like jacket we might translate today, or to clothing in general, which appears to be the point here. The second clause mentions that their feet, the text has the singular foot, used collectively here, as in 1 Samuel 25, verse 24. The textual apparatus notes that the Samaritan Pentateuch and the Syriac versions have the plural. They're probably simply translating the sense here. In any case, the text says that their feet did not batzach, swell up, for 40 years. Note the way that Hebrew works with numbers. The number is plural, but the object to which the number refers is singular, matched in this case by the singular pronoun this, ze in Hebrew. Of course, we would translate this entirely as a plural, these 40 years in English. The next sentence continues the didactic teaching theme, again beginning with an intended result clause. Verse 5. Vayadata im levavecha, so that you will know with all your heart, ki ka'asher yiyaser ish et beno, Yahweh Eloheka, miyas recha. That just as a man disciplines his son, Your God disciplines you. The verb yasar is interesting. In the Kal, the Nithal, and the very rare Nithpael, and sometimes in the Piel, this root is simply used to communicate the idea of instructing or teaching. In other places, in the Piel, it has the sense of chastise or rebuke. In that way, the usage of the root makes the very point of our text here, that God's discipline is didactic. Its purpose is to teach, and what it teaches us is to trust or have faith in Him. Why? The next verse answers the question. Verse 6. Ushamerta et mitzvot Yahweh alahecha laleketh baderkau u leyira otho, so that you will keep the commandments of your God Yahweh by walking in His ways and fearing Him. As earlier in our text, we have two more infinitive constructs preceded by the preposition lamet, indicating how the previous action is to be carried out. So we translate laleketh by walking and u leyirah by fearing. Having explained God's didactic purpose, the passage now moves on to the promise that God gives that accompanies His instruction, and which is emphasized at the beginning in verse 1. Verse 7. Ki Yahweh Eloheka mabiaka el eretz tova. For your God Yahweh is bringing you into a good land. The key that begins this phrase introduces an explanation, what grammarians call the epexegetical use of key. The nature of the goodness of the land is spelled out by the appositive, or more accurately, the series of appositive clauses that follow. Eretz nachale mayim, ayanoth, vatihomoth, yotzeim babaka uvahar. A land of streams of water, ayanoth, springs, and Tohomoth, deep waters, flowing out among the valleys and mountains. It's a little unclear what the term Tohomoth, deep waters, refers to. Are these deep waters of water perhaps the floods of the rainy season that swell the normal water courses until they overflow their banks? The word flowing seems to imply this. But this would be a very unusual use of the term tahom, deep, which normally refers to the ocean or to the sea. So perhaps this refers to deep lakes, like the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. That makes more sense of the term tahom, but doesn't fit the term flowing quite as well. Well, there's no clear-cut answer to this. In either case, the general point that the land will be well watered and therefore fertile is clear enough. And it is this fertility of the land that is emphasized in the next verse, where the description of this good land to which Yahweh is leading them continues. Verse 8. Here we get a whole series of agricultural terms, perhaps less well known to the casual reader. Eretz Chita, a land of wheat. U'seorah, and barley. Wagefen, and vines. U'te'enah, and fig trees. U'rimon, and pomegranates. Eretz Zedshimen, a land of olive oil. U'davash, and honey. The effect of all this agricultural prosperity is made clear in the next verse, verse 9. Eretz asher lo b'miskenuth. Verse 9. Eretz asher lo b'miskenuth. a land which is without poverty. This is the only occurrence of the noun Miskenuth in the Old Testament, but its meaning is clarified by both some related terms in the Bible and some cognate terms in other languages as well. The description is expanded further in the following clauses. Tokel ba'lechem, in it you will eat bread. Lo techesar kalba, and you will not lack anything in it. Here kol does not mean all or every, but coupled with the negative means anything. Eretz asher evaneha barzel, it is a land whose stones are iron, or we'd probably say like iron. The point appears to be that they will be good for construction. They will build good, strong houses and fortifications. Ume Chaharecha, and from its hill country, it's Techzov Nechosheth, you will dig copper. Here it's helpful to keep the historical context in mind. This is the Bronze Age, and copper was the main element used in making bronze, both for tools and for weapons. Verse 10. Va'akalta usavatha, you will eat and be satisfied. Uberachta et Yahweh Eloheka al ha'aretz tova asher natan lach, and you will bless Yahweh your God for, or concerning, the good land which he has given to you. Before we wrap up, we will add just a few observations about preaching this text. This text sets the divine exhortation to adhere to God's teaching in the context of the promise that God has made to Israel's ancestors, to give them a fertile and prosperous land in which to live. God calls his people to full and faithful obedience to everything that God has instructed Israel through Moses. Like the similar injunctions in Exodus 19-24, this passage raises an unanswered question. What will happen if Israel cannot keep every prescription of the divine teaching perfectly? In the book of Deuteronomy, the answer comes ultimately in chapter 28, verse 15 and following, with the curses that will fall upon Israel for disobeying God. In the book of Exodus, in the aftermath of the golden calf episode, God taught Israel that their continuing to be his people depends not on their ability to keep the whole law perfectly, but upon the nature of God, who is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Exodus 34, 5-7. Passages such as this perform what we sometimes call the second function of the law, that is, to show us our inability to reconcile ourselves with God by keeping the Torah perfectly, and remind us of our utter dependence upon God's grace, both for our salvation and for our remaining to be the people of God when we stumble into sin. That does not mean that God is insincere when commanding perfect obedience. The demand of perfect obedience is clear and unremitting throughout the Scripture. It points us to Christ, who on the cross has taken upon himself the whole wrath of God poured out upon us for our faithlessness. He bore the punishment for our sin and has become our righteousness. It is through him and him alone that the promises that God makes to Israel of a good land are ultimately fulfilled. The kind of language about the land that we have in this passage is sometimes called prophetic hyperbole. But the emphasis on wealth and prosperity is not hyperbole any more than it is intended as a promise that riches and wealth will be given to every Christian today. Both of these errors fail to appreciate the eschatological dimension of these texts, as in Exodus 23, verse 25 and following, when God says there will be no disease, or no miscarriage, or no women who cannot have children, or no one who will ever go hungry, and that there will be complete prosperity and riches for all. These promises point us to something beyond the physical land of Israel, to God's promises made full in an eschatological land, a restored land of creation into which the Messiah will lead the people of God. In this way, both the warning of the law in this text and the promise of the land point us to Christ, who both fulfills the law for us and leads us into his eschatological kingdom, where alone all of the promises of God to his people will be fully and permanently fulfilled. I'm Dr. David Adams, thanking you for joining us for this week's lectionary at lunch, as we have examined Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 1 to 10.